Welcome to Sitting Around Talking Movies. I'm Neil Rosen, the Talking Pictures podcast. As always, joined
by Stadley
Bill
still
Bergoli,
calls it that.
Yes.
And Bill McCuddy.
Yes, I'm here.
And Mike Sargent's back with us this week.
Thank you very much.
There you go. Hey, we got a lot to talk about this week. You know what we're talking about? We're talking about LBJ, the movie with Woody Harrelson, directed by Rob Reiner. We're talking about Lady Bird, the directorial and writing date. Well, she's written another movie, but this is the writing directorial debut of Greta
She's actually
Gerwig.
Directed another movie. This is her second directorial effort.
All right, what a
but this is a big one. This is the big...
And starring Saoirse Ronan from Hannah and Brooklyn. We're also talking about the new Thor movie, Thor Ragnarok.
It's explained in the movie.
Okay.
Briefly.
And
which apparently you didn't see, did you, Neil?
What's that?
It's explained in the movie, the title.
We're going to talk about the new Gilbert Gottfried documentary.
And
we've got an exclusive interview that Bill Bergoli did, a very lengthy interview, because Bill Bergoli, which we'll get into, is like Gilbert's one of his best friends. They talk every night.
Not good enough to be in the movie.
I'm going to talk about that.
I know.
And Bill McCuddy wants to talk about White Famous, the new show that's on Showtime. I want to talk about this horrible David S. Pumpkin special that was on SNL last week. And Mike Sargent wants to talk about the Light of the Moon.
Light of the Moon.
The new movie. But let's start. You want to start talking about Lady Bird? Lady Bird it is. Bill McCuddy loved this movie.
So did the audience, and so does Rotten Tomatoes. The audience I saw it with, was it the closing night? It was one of the later nights of the New York Film Festival. Alice Tully Hall, so it seats 800 or 900 people. It was packed. She was there with some of the stars, and it played like gangbusters in the room. It's a coming of age. Well, actually, if you're a Greta Gerwig fan, it's probably the closest to a memoir that she could write. It's about a young woman, 17 years old,
takes place
living in California.
1992,
right, right after 9/11, shortly after 9/11, the Iraq War is sort of a backdrop to the thing.
I'm sorry.
And she's lives in, I think it's Stockton, California, which she calls...
No, she lives in Sacramento.
Sacramento, thank you. And she calls it the Midwest of California. She can't wait to get out of there. She has an incredibly difficult relationship with her mother, who's played by Laurie Metcalf, and brilliantly cast, I think, too. When I heard Laurie Metcalf, I thought this is going to be kind of in a made-for-TV mode. Not at all. This is like The Edge of 17 or Diary
Tracy
of a Teenager.
Tracy Letts is the dad.
Tracy Letts is the dad who is lets go from his job. They're a middle, lower-income, middle-income family going through some very tough times.
She says she literally lives on the wrong side of the track.
She wants to go to college. She wants to go back east or someplace, any place but community college.
She wants to go to a New York or... She wants a Northeast University. She wants to out of that town. They cannot afford, really. They wanted to go to a local college, but she's dreaming of specifically New York, but she'll take anything in the Northeast.
So that is Bill McCuddy giving you the whole synopsis. Thank you, Neil. And so so that's the film, and
I'm
a big fan. I like Miss America. I like Mistress America. I mean, I like everything else she's done. Frances Ha, and I think this is... If she's not in it, she directs and wrote, but
it's
and probably
like Woody Allen. You know how Woody Allen would hire younger guys to play himself,
right?
So she essentially did a Woody Allen and got this Saoirse Ronan.
Yeah, I think that's good. I think that's a good point, and I think for a coming of age film, I think it's one of the. I think it's an Oscar contender, and I think definitely for a screenplay, I think she's going to get an Oscar nomination.
I think the film is all right. And I wish...
Yeah, good. You're all right with it.
I don't love
the rest of you think?
I wish I had seen the film.
Why didn't you see it?
Before you told me that it is on your top 10 list of the year. And before Jack Rico, who did the podcast last week, said, I love this film. And everybody's telling me how great it is, which is kind of the worst way to see a movie.
It is.
My expectations were so high.
Because it kind of forces you to make an artificial...
It's a small film.
...decision to be against it.
It's a small film. Had I seen it with no advance hype from my colleagues, friends, I would have gone, like, this is kind of quirky and fun, but I expected more from it. But that said, if I get away from that, yeah, it's okay. It's fine. I mean, I think I've seen the movie...
100% on Rotten Tomato.
I think I've seen the movie... Many different versions of this movie in other
movies. Okay, so I mentioned The Edge of 17. Do you think it's better than The Edge of 17?
I like The Edge of 17.
I like
better.
The Edge of 17.
Haley Steinfeld better than Saoirse Ronan?
I like The Edge of 17, maybe a little
better.
That
was a broader comic community take.
But, I think. Yeah, I like that better. Look, I don't dislike the film. It's an okay film. I just don't see it as an Oscar contender unless
hello.
It's a really weak year. I mean, I love Saoirse Ronan. As you know, she's one of my favorite actresses. She was brilliant in Brooklyn. She's...
You don't think she's great in this?
It
sort of all carries on her.
She got nominated for an Oscar for... Oh, it was like a Merchant Ivory-ish kind of thing. What was the movie?
Oh, Atonement?
Atonement, yes.
Atonement, that's right.
Atonement.
She was,
that's right. That's the little girl that starts Atonement.
Atonement.
That's right.
I think she's a brilliant actress. And she goes through, this is a coming-of-age film. I think she's great in it. And you see her at the end. I won't say what happens with her fate with college, but she's years older. You see her at the end. And she just does every phase really well. I just think the movie's okay. I wasn't laugh out loud funny like throughout, but I don't think it was going for that. I'd say it was okay. I'd say it was like 2 3/4 apples if I was going to rate it.
But not in your top 10 list.
No.
As it will be in many, many, many other critics.
I don't hate the movie. I just think it's okay. I think it's a nice movie.
All right.
There you go. All right, moving on. Thor, the big tentpole blockbuster, several hundred million dollar budgeted movie. Mike Sargent, take it away.
Well, this is the third in the Thor series, and at this point we're familiar with the Marvel Universe, we're familiar with Thor, we've got backstory, and what Marvel's done is, knowing all this, they can go into a movie without any exposition. So this movie starts out with Thor basically preventing what he thinks Ragnarok is, which is when, an evil creature with lots of power is going to destroy Asgard.
Which is his home.
Which is his home, which is Thor's home, which is where he grew up with all the other Asgardians.
Is that near Sacramento?
It looks like it is. It was on fire earlier this year. But point being that, so what happens is that we learn that Ragnarok is not really over. It's really going to happen. I don't want to give away the plot because there's a lot of machinations it'll give away. But Chris Hemsworth returns as Thor this time. Plot devices we've seen. He gets captured. He's going to be turned into a gladiator. They shave his hair, and that's why he doesn't have the long hair. And
is it plot heavy, not action heavy?
It's both. But what's heavy?
I'm told there are a lot of plots in it. Well, it could have lost a
it's
couple.
It's plot heavy.
If there's any nit
it's
on it.
It's action heavy, but most importantly, it's got a lot of humor.
Yeah, Bill Bregoli, you were mentioning it's funny, right?
It's really funny.
Very funny.
Any movie that Jeff Goldblum shows up as an intergalactic reality show host,
exactly.
Well,
but funnier than Guardians of the Galaxy, I'm told.
It is.
It's easily as funny as Guardians.
Well, I thought that the first Thor movie,
definitely funnier than the second.
When Thor gets off the planet, the Anthony Hopkins, and he's all of a sudden he's a fish out of water. And he's trying to adjust to modern day American society, and he's this guy, this medieval guy, was hysterically funny.
I agree.
So would you say it was as funny as
that? I think it's funnier than that. It's funnier than
really
that, because at this point we get. We get him, and if I asked you, how would you describe Chris Hemsworth's take on Thor? I think you'd be kind of hard pressed, really. In this one, you really get how he's playing.
So you walk out with a grin, and you're thinking, you're definitely going to recommend it.
Directed by the guy who directed, I can't pronounce his name, but he directed Hunt for the Wilder People. Remember that?
Yes, and he also did that documentary that you love so much about the. What We Say in the Shadows, or What We Do in the Shadows.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
So he's got a sense.
So this was a huge.
But that's not a documentary.
This was a
documentary.
That's a mockumentary by the guys who did Flight of the Conchords.
But this was like a big gamble for the studio to push all their chips in on this guy, and it sounds like he's really delivered.
Yeah. Well, you know what? What Marvel's done that's smart here, and I think that this is, we'll see what happens.
They've looked for fresh visions.
They look for fresh visions, and it's like when you change the artist or writing team on a comic book, they're taking it in a new direction. Uh-huh. That's what comic books have been known for. All of a sudden, somebody comes in and takes Daredevil in a new way, or Batman in a new way. And so what they've done with the comic book movies is they've allowed each comic character to have its own brand, and each film to get a different kind of director. And I think that that's smart, because each film has a different feel. Like, if you didn't like one superhero movie, you might like this one, because it's so different. This is nothing like Spider-Man.
So, LBJ... Woody Harrelson, who apparently was, who's from Texas and was concerned that he wasn't getting the right accent, the right, Texas accent correctly when he did this LBJ. What do you think of LBJ there, Bill? What do you tell us about LBJ?
Well, it's a very tight timeline. It takes place as he joined the ticket with Kennedy, and this was back when conventions were brawls behind the stages and wasn't like a pre-planned like they are now, or they're just television events. He gets on the ticket with Kennedy. He has a lot of fights with Robert Kennedy and Kennedy's clan, but he's on the ticket. Then Kennedy's assassinated, and he has to get Congress behind him in order to pass civil rights legislation. That's about as far as it goes. It does not go up to Vietnam, but because it's so tight, it's a lot more watchable than some huge meandering biopic.
Even though you might think that, as some critics have said, that it's making a big mistake by not focusing on some of the later stuff like the Vietnam War, and now we're learning from these new documents that were just released the other day that maybe Johnson had a hand in the assassination or nothing.
That
like
rumor's been circulating. I know, but
I'm not saying that he did. I'm just saying that none of that is addressed because the timeline ends kind of abruptly,
tight.
I'm told.
And Rob Reiner, I actually got to talk to Rob Reiner the other day, and he was telling me that when you watch it, you're going to think, well, this is when Congress actually passed legislation.
You also think of, what does a real president look like and how does a real government function? I mean, and you kind of, you know, you can't help but know what political times we're living in. And I can tell you, just based on my own experience, that we finished this film long before Trump became president. So the film has changed. I mean, we haven't changed the frame of it, but the film, the way people react to the film is different from the way they reacted before.
So now maybe Rob Reiner has a hit. Maybe. We don't know. It hasn't opened yet. But it's been a long stretch for him.
So long.
Well, it's funny you say that. First of all, I did like this movie more than I expected to. And when I interviewed Rob Reiner, it was for the film he did. What did he do just before this?
North?
No, North was a long time.
Anyway,
North was the beginning of the downslide.
It's been a long career. It's funny you said that, because when I said to him, I suggested, not saying you made a lot of bombs, I kind of said, you know, do you worry? I kind of framed it like, yeah, I spoke to Coppola, and he said, you know, should you worry about trying to outdo yourself, da 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 da, and, you know, are your successes behind you? He was like, what do you mean? He's like, no, this, you know, he was really defending all the stuff he had done. But I have to say, this film I thought was very tight. I thought it was a good script. It was like a Aaron Sorkin-ish kind of script. And
that's funny, because Rob Reiner direct The American President?
Yes,
which was written by Aaron Sorkin. So
it had that feel.
I haven't seen Molly's Game.
Not funny.
Which is Sorkin's film. Have you seen Molly's Game?
No,
I haven't seen that yet. But I have to say, I thought the writing was really good. I thought Woody Harrelson was spot on.
Also, Richard Jenkins is very good.
Richard Jenkins is good. And I got to tell you, I sat there looking at one of his LBJ's assistants going, who is that guy? Who is that guy? Who is that? It's C. Thomas Howell. I almost fell out my chair.
Oh, my God.
Exactly. I haven't seen him.
You don't
forever.
See Thomas Howell often.
You don't see Thomas.
I mean, in the trailer, we could all see that Woody doesn't really, he's buried under prosthetics, but he doesn't really look that much like Johnson. Or do you just kind of accept it after a while?
You accept it. You accept it because it's not.
I don't accept the voice, though. I don't care how much he worked on the accent. I still hear Woody Harrelson.
Yeah, me too.
That's a problem for me.
He has a higher voice than
I don't think you will care, because his performance is so engaging. The writing is so good. The directing is so
Oscar nomination?
I think he might get an Oscar nomination.
Boy, this is the year of the prosthetic.
It's a lot better than the Hoffa makeup.
Right, but I mean, I'm thinking of the other one that they say is going to be a big contender, and that's the Churchill film.
Darkest Hour, which I saw last week.
And we'll talk about that when we get closer to the opening, but I think that's your...
Well, my point was...
I think that's your big Oscar movie. What do you think?
It's going to be...
Unless, guys, you're missing the whole...
But the Oscars don't do, the Golden Globes will pick up.
You're missing the whole point of the question, which is, with all the prosthetics, does the Academy go,
No, I don't think so. I think it depends on what he does, you know, and I think he really does good work here. And I think that
Woody in LBJ we're talking
Woody
about.
Woody and LBJ we're talking about. I think he does good work here. You believe the character. I liked the sense of, you know, Rob Reiner was clearly aware, you know, you see these scenes where they're deciding on civil rights and it's a room full of white men. There's not one person of color there, you know, and it reminds is very prevalent, you know, to what's going on today, where, you know, they make legislation about women. There's no woman in the room. All these things. But I'll tell you what really stood out to me, because this movie really, I didn't expect it to, but it really helps inform where we are today, you know, with how did Trump win? People go, how did he win? You know, back then, you know, when you see the Southern delegates literally come together, a bunch of racists saying, thank God we got one of our own in the White House, you realize that there's a large part of America that wants things to go back to when they were in power.
Did either of you, because I've seen this, see the, because there was, I saw it on Broadway, but then it became a...
That was with Cranston, right?
Bryan Cranston.
Right. One-man show?
Yes. It wasn't a one-man show at all. It was,
it was
a full cast on it. But Bryan Cranston was so believable as LBJ that when he came out for the curtain call, and somebody, one of the talk show hosts made this, I made the remark, and somebody made the same exact remark. It's like he didn't change his makeup, but you saw Bryan Cranston there, where you did not see Bryan Cranston at all during the performance. You saw Johnson, but neither one of you saw the LBJ thing, because I wanted to know how you thought the performances compared to the Bryan Cranston one, which does,
The play deals with the same period, roughly the same period of time,
the
right?
The play is predominantly, which Bill Bregoli is saying, does not touch upon the passing the civil rights legislation, where that's the center of the play, is how Johnson used his political clout. Like, in other words, it was Kennedy's vision to and I don't know if you could tell me if the movie touches upon this.
Completely.
That it's Kennedy's vision to pass the Civil Rights Act, but Kennedy, had he not been shot, was kind of a rookie, you know, and Johnson was a political animal that could pull all the strings
in
the Congress to get this thing passed, and if it wasn't for somebody like Johnson, who knew how to do, you know, you do this, or I'm going to say, I remember very distinctly in the play, he didn't have the votes, and he would call senators in and say, okay, well, I know that you did this, you know, and I'm going to make that public, all right, I'll sign your bill. And then this one, okay, you want that reservoir expanded in your town? Okay, we'll do that, and then you do that, and you know, and he just knew how to work politics.
Well, John Kennedy had that, but it was his father.
Well, you know, the best reference to that, they touch upon that exact
And it
difference.
Shows you exactly how the civil rights he got it done.
And you realize that Kennedy would have had a much harder time. You know, two things he says. He says, one, never underestimate the power of a martyr, okay, and that influence. And two, he says, there's a difference between a show horse and a workhorse. He said, the show horse looks great, and that's Kennedy. He said, the workhorse is the one that does all the work, and that's LBJ.
You know, Mike, you were talking
about... Well, that's easy to say since he died.
Well, there's he said it while he was alive.
What I'm saying is we don't know whether or not Kennedy could have gotten that legislation passed.
This is true.
If he had lived.
Well, look, you could always theorize when, you know, they say that Kennedy was going to pull out of Vietnam, that it was a failed, you know, it was Johnson who escalated the troops. You know, it was a small amount of troops that were in South Vietnam, and Kennedy said, this isn't going well, and the French didn't win, and I'm getting out of here. And it was Johnson who decided, apparently, and this line is in the trailer, Johnson saying, I'm going to make all of Kennedy's, all of Kennedy's vision. So, you know, maybe, I don't know, Johnson decided to escalate the war into this full-blown thing. Maybe Kennedy would have just ended it. I don't know.
I have theories on that, but what were you going to say, Bill?
You mentioned scenes where it's all these white guys talking about civil rights legislation. There are scenes where there are black people while they're talking about civil rights,
which was great. I was going to
mention
they're the help, and I thought that
was
great.
Talking about them like they're not there. It's
exactly
amazing.
Which was a common thing. And you know what else I have to say,
that's as fucked up as, like you said, Mike, as a whole bunch of men deciding on women's body, reproductive rights. I mean, where the hell does a guy get off deciding for women? I mean, you know, really, I don't even think it should be balanced. I think women should be have the it shouldn't be any white men deciding on
or NASA saying we should go to Mars with no Martians in the room.
There you go.
Exactly.
I'm going to get to another movie in a minute, but I want to switch this to television for a second, and I just want to mention that, you know, I turned on Saturday Night Live this past Saturday, and it was an abomination. And I was reading that I'm not alone in this. Slate and Vulture and all these other websites you're talking about, they devoted it to this stupid character that Tom Hanks played in a script called David S. Pumpkins, and they had an animated special that was completely unwatchable.
Can I just say that I never got that David S. Pumpkins thing
in the first place?
They became this hipster thing that everybody thought was cool.
Tell me why
when
it's
they
funny.
Did it.
I mean, I don't.
Where that was in the haunted house. Do you remember this bit where the people are in a haunted mansion and it has an elevator, and every time the door opens, David S. Pumpkins, which is this character they made that I guess they thought was going to be like church lady or something, and it resonated. resonated, I guess, David with certain Pumpkins. Audience.
Yeah,
and
it's not
it
funny,
was, it, I found it only amusing because they got Tom Hanks to do it, sort of like punked him into it, I thought. But then it became kind of this thing. So here we go. We're at Mrs. McCuddy and I are doing the same thing you did because we're as lonely and as pathetic as you and Mrs.
Bobby
Rosen.
And my wife and I turned it on. And we're like,
what the hell is this?
Garbage.
And it gets 30 seconds in and I could tell it stank. And my wife is like, no, let's give it like a couple more minutes. And we did. And it just never got better. I didn't see who produced it, but you know, I know Robert Smigel, who's very gifted.
The character
and did,
was created by Bobby Moynihan, Tom Hanks, and Mikey Day.
Right,
and
but they, I mean, in terms of then turning it into something 30 minutes long, I mean, this suffers.
Hanks has played
this suffered, yeah, I, he, or a guy that sounded just like Hanks's voice. This suffers exactly the same fate that so many movies that get blown up from SNL sketches, which is they just don't
it's
hold
Pat
together.
Movie.
And this is yeah,
remember that
or
one,
A Night at the Roxy.
Or the Night at the Roxbury.
This
exactly.
is 30
or the Coneheads
minutes.
Movie.
Or yeah, the Coneheads. I was sort of appalled.
Yeah, but
by
here's
it.
The thing. I found the Coneheads to be funny in a 5-minute sketch, and I found It's Pat to be funny, and I like you, and I found Roxbury to be funny, but I never got the David S. Pumpkins thing to begin with either.
Right.
And now it's an animated thing. I don't know. I thought it was awful. So you saw something on TV. I'm a big fan of Californication, the David Duchovny series that was on Showtime.
Right.
And the creator of that has now done another show called White Famous, and you wanted to talk about that, Bill.
Well, I bring it up because you brought up Saturday Night Live. This is Jay Farrow, who was the great mimic and could
who got
do...
got fired from Saturday Night.
Well, or they parted company, maybe because he thought he had a career in motion pictures. Look how many people have left SNL thinking that was going to happen. This is the first project. He's basically playing Jamie Foxx, and Jamie Foxx is the executive producer. Much in the way Wahlberg spun off Entourage, this is kind of Jamie Foxx's kind of Entourage, and the idea, I love the title, White Famous, that you're not really somebody in Hollywood until you're as famous as somebody white is famous. So that's the terminology that I guess Jamie Foxx coined.
Isn't this
and
kind
Jay
of
Farrow is
Jamie semi-autobiographical?
Well, let me go back. As the way Wahlberg made Entourage and built it around his life, I'm saying Jamie Foxx has come up with this idea that maybe Jay Farrow can sort of mirror what I went through when I was first coming out to Hollywood. I have to say that Jay Farrow is kind of a big disappointment for me. He's kind of not a great actor, and I know Seinfeld wasn't a great actor when he got Seinfeld, and I don't think David, I don't think anybody thinks Larry David is a brilliant actor, but they're really good at playing themselves. Jay Farrow is kind of a nothing to me in this thing, and for that reason, at the core, I think it's flawed. So
well,
I was disappointed in
nothing,
it.
Right?
He can play other people, but he can't play himself. Is
do
my
they call
is my feeling
the character Jamie?
No, his name is. I can't remember. I watched two episodes, and that's how memorable it is. I really don't.
But it's
don't.
That guy from California. What's his name? Kapinkas or the guy?
Yeah, it starts with a K.
Yeah. Well, anyway, but it's the same guy because the writing on Californication was really good.
Yeah, this is kind of flat. It's the kind of situations that you would see a Larry David go into. Like, he has to go with his agent to a big dinner party that a celebrity is throwing or that a celebrity chef is cooking at, and he brings one of his posse with him. It kind of fizzles
for me. How
many
episodes
so
did you get through? Bill?
I've only seen two, and I was or one and a
not
half, actually.
Not recommended.
No, I don't love it. I'll tell you what I do love. That's my video pick of the week. We're going to get to yours in a second.
The Orville.
The Orville is so bad. So and he's so talented.
Well, you know what is he's
what's
talented?
Wrong with Seth MacFarlane that he thought this
exactly
was going to be like?
I watched the Orville.
I'll tell you what's wrong.
It's watchable. It is watchable. I don't think it's great, but it's watchable.
So is QVC.
Here's the thing about the Orville.
The Orville.
Two things that are wrong with the Orville is A, he can't decide whether it's a comedy or.
That's correct.
Right.
That's right. That's one. Two, he really, really, really wanted to do Star Trek: The Next Generation or Star Trek. He wanted to do Star Trek.
Why don't we tell people what the Orville? By the way, there's
the
so
Orville
much.
Seth MacFarlane.
Well, I think they can glean it from basically
Seth
what we just said.
It's a Star Trek parody, but not really because
it's not a parody. It's Star Trek.
It's funny.
It's kind of an homage. It's kind of like trying to live up to
the plots.
These are all nice words.
I agree with you, Mike, 100%. They're trying to be funny, and there are humors. Like, he has his wife, his ex-wife on the ship, and you know. And there's this, so it's humorous, or it's trying to be humorous, but they also have these serious Star Trek type write plots on it. But see, and the comedy and the drama don't really work within each other.
The problem is not the comedy and the drama, Vix, which it's uneven at best, but he's just not a good science fiction writer. And he wrote every episode, and he's not
no Family Guy.
Family Guy's funny. He's a good
Family Guy
writer,
is funny.
But science fiction, you need to have some meat on the bone. I've heard that everybody's talking about this third episode where, you know, the changing gender of a baby, the Worf character, which I've heard is so good. I got through two episodes. And I feel like I'm watching Next Generation, but the first two seasons of Next Generation before it got good. That's what it feels like. It's sterile, but watchable. Okay.
Yeah, watchable at best.
It's moderately
but not like
engaged.
It is not a point
and
of the television.
Everybody is better in it than him.
Right, so we were getting this. We
I'm
often
sorry,
do.
Your video pick.
My video pick of the week.
My video pick
is
Ingrid Goes West, which is this great little film that Aubrey Plaza's in.
Aubrey Plaza.
With Elizabeth Olsen.
Aubrey Plaza.
Aubrey Plaza is sort of stalking this girl who she sees on Instagram and wants to be like, moves out to California to be near her, and becomes her friend. It's very telling about social media, about the time we live in, and it's very, very funny. In the middle of it, one of the things they do, kind of the way I have Robert Evans shit all over my house because, you know, I love that Kid Stays in the Picture. And like, so she...
He loves Robert Evans. Likes his memorabilia. Go ahead, Bill. Your imitation.
Should I have made Bill McCuddy a friend of mine? No way. Would I do it again? In a second. All right. Anyway, so... the way I'm a big Robert Evans fan, she is this Olsen sort of mentor to Aubrey Plaza, is a big Joan Didion fan, believes Joan Didion was like something every young girl should read, even though it turns out she's never read her. So for that reason, my other pick of the week is a great new documentary that our friend Griffin Dunn made about his aunt Joan Didion, who wrote Golden Girl and with her husband, a lot of other, and some great books, Play It As It Lays. The doc is called Joan Didion, The Center Will Not Hold. There are lots of celebrities in it. As I said, Griffin made it with love and care, and it's 89% right now on Rotten Tomatoes. I think it's on Netflix, but it's all over, and I recommend it.
Before we get to our big interview and a big discussion on the Gottfried movie.
Yes, let's do anything to make this even longer.
Mike wants to tell us
about
the
movie.
Something happening that you
like.
The movie called The Light of the Moon.
The
Light of the Moon. And interesting enough about Aubrey Plaza, the main actress, her name is Stephanie Beatrice. She reminds me of Aubrey Plaza quite a bit. But this is a movie about a woman who's an architect, a New York City architect, a Latina, who's successful, young, millennial. And she goes out one night with some friends from the office. And her boyfriend's supposed to come, but he's kind of self-absorbed doing his own thing. He comes by to tell her he can't go. She goes out, gets drunk, dances, gets hit on by guys. She's fine, but makes the mistake, which unfortunately is the world we live in, of walking home semi-drunk with her headphones on. And of course, she gets attacked and she gets raped. And what this movie does, first of all, it's written and directed by a woman, which is Jessica Thompson. And so the way a woman will handle rape is so different than the way a man would. And as a film
critic, as a director?
As a director, as a writer, as of all of it. Okay, even though the DP is a woman as well. And it's just handled in a very different way. And, you know, as a film critic, you guys are like me. You know, most of the films you see are written, directed, produced by men. And you can tell... For me, I can always tell when a woman's made a film right away. There's all these details that you just wouldn't get. And what this does is take the 6 weeks after it happens, which is much more devastating. The act itself takes 3 minutes. Okay, but her whole life unravels on many, many levels. And it's really a surprisingly powerful film that I highly recommend.
Which I saw as well. And they do it on a little budget, but they also get... A lot of the details. I was in a situation, frankly.
A lot of details.
I was in a situation, frankly, where a friend of mine was raped or attacked. Mm. And it was different than the movie in that she went to a ladies' room in a Manhattan restaurant that's no longer there. And she never came out of the ladies' room. And I was waiting for her and waiting for her. And finally, the waiter said, "You've got to check on your friend. She was beaten up and bleeding. We had to take her to the hospital." And movie gets... right, that I related to was the cops told me that night as we were in the hospital, said, "Look, you're going to blame yourself for this.
Right.
You're going to feel so incredibly guilty. It is not your fault. It's not your fault, but you're going to blame yourself." And the next morning, I was on a subway platform hitting my head against a column going, "Why didn't I check on her? Check on her?"
And the boyfriend.
So a lot of this spoke to me, that whole situation. Plus, I knew this woman well enough that we were talking about what happened to her, and she had to go to therapy. They had a special in New York. We were taken care of by the Special Victims Unit, and they had a therapy sessions for her to go to. But she had the same difficulty as the character in the movie.
Did they ever catch the perpetrator?
We went to trial. They did catch him because he worked at the restaurant. This guy was sort of psycho. They
give the restaurant a plug.
No, I'm kidding. They no longer exist, thankfully. But they caught the guy, and we took him to trial. They found him guilty. And then we both got a call from the assistant district attorney after the trial saying, thank you for taking this all the way through, because once he was in prison, we got his DNA, and we tied him to 7 rapes.
Wow.
So, and that's usually the deal. The other thing I have to say about the boyfriend thing, which I thought was interesting, because it is her story, this character, but they really, all the male characters, I mean, you've got a rapist, obviously, is the antagonist, but the male character is very believable, and he is kind of an asshole. But he starts.
Where do we
really
see this
nice
movie?
It's in theaters. Comes out Friday.
Is it also on demand or on?
I don't know if it's on
or
demand,
on you know, Netflix or something.
You remember going to theaters, Neil?
Yeah. Back in the day.
We're going to switch gears completely now. I definitely piqued my interest
on
this movie.
The last thing I was going to say is that he tries to be good to her, and she is like, "Well, it took this for you to treat me correctly," and so he can't really win. Yeah. You know, so, and I thought that was pretty powerful too.
That's like my wife around our anniversary.
So, I'm going to now do something. We're going to talk about this Gilbert Gottfried documentary, which is called.
Those of you who have Gilbert fans who are listening now have been waiting through all of this to get through now, to this long exclusive interview we
now
have.
Now, the movie is a look at Gilbert's life. I saw the movie, it kind of looks at, it's basically, you know, how he became a comic, and you see him now with he's married, his wife's name is Dara, and he's got 2 kids, and it's very 180 from that, you know, frantic character that you see on stage. You know, he doesn't even do the voice, you know, that's not his real voice, I gotta tell you. You know, that's not the Gilbert Gottfried voice in real life. But what we have here is not only do we have a lengthy interview, which we're going to play in a moment, that Bill Bregoli did. Bill Bregoli, as I said at the top of the podcast, is very good friends with Gilbert. And Bill talks to him pretty much, you used to talk to him like once every night, right?
I talked to him before I left here for the podcast.
And let me ask you something.
Did he give you any advice?
No. Before I even tell you my opinion on the film, I've always wanted to know, how long do you speak to him on the phone per night? You said like it's a half an hour, and what do you talk to, what do you and Gilbert talk about?
Desperately wants to learn how to make friends. Give him some pointers.
Talk about like what's in the news? Do you talk about make fun of old movies?
I mean, what are we talking about today? We were talking about all the latest people to be accused of sexual misconduct in the business. Talked about those guys. We also talked about his appearance on Colbert last night.
But would you say over the how many years you've been friendly with Gilbert now? Like
about 23.
Right. Do you predominantly talk about pop culture? Like look at this horrible movie with Vincent Price or something?
Sure.
Because if you watch Gilbert's act,
that would have been pop culture a couple of years ago.
You also called me up and asked me to spell words.
Really?
Yeah.
You're his spell check?
Yeah, I'm his spell check.
One of the best moments in the movie is when he's with a little kid on an 18-month-year-old on a cruise, a comedy cruise, and he goes, and they're looking out the window, and he's like, you should be much more impressed with who I am. And then he says, have you ever heard my John MacGyver impression? He starts doing this completely arcane. Really spot on John MacGyver, which nobody, half the people watching won't even get, which I thought was hilarious. But it's a great example of how he lives in his own world. And his material is his own. He has his own. And everybody talks about that. Leno is in this thing.
Bill.
Bill Burr is in this. What other comics are in this?
Whoopi drops by. Jeff Ross talks about and Hefner and the thing they talk about him. And I've been a big. I've seen this film too, and I liked it a little more than you did, I think. Although I realize it's about him, and he lives a pretty normal, mundane life. He travels a lot, which is boring. When you do stand up comedy, it's you're gone for the weekends, and he somehow has an adorable wife and family that he seems to adore, and they seem to adore him.
It was okay. To me, what was more interesting was there was an episode of I think it was, it's a white wife swap or something.
Celebrity wife swap.
Celebrity wife swap. Thicke, and right, the late Alan Thicke and his wife swapped with Dara and Gilbert, and Dara was all of a sudden living this luxurious life on a ranch somewhere out in the out in California with them or somewhere, and
Tony, I think.
You know, and Gilbert's Alan Thicke's wife is living with Gilbert, and they're going to the 99-cent store or something like that.
Right.
And that's where you learn that Gilbert's cheap. And I know they play that up because reality TV is scripted, but I found that to be actually more, a little more insightful into Gilbert because it was shorter and it was funnier. This is, you know, I guess what I liked about this was more about the early clips of Gilbert, like on Letterman and right. on Saturday Night Live, and learning about. I mean, there's a whole subplot with his sister. What did you think about that? About his sister?
Who's his family's fascinating, and he's you know, the quiet one in the family. He turns out to be Gilbert Gottfried. You know, his father was a handyman, and he can't. You know, he needs a note to get into to Home Depot. But look, I think it's, if you're a fan, this is like the DVD bonus. A backstory of what he's doing, and you know, it's a little mundane in some places, but if you're a huge fan, I think you'll like it. And I think the important thing is we have access to one of the best friends of
well,
his.
I want to know what one of his best friends, Bill Bregoli, thought of the movie. Or do you have to recuse yourself from this because
yeah, you sitting this one out
with Gilbert? Can you?
Because Gilbert's probably listening to this right now.
Yeah, I know, Gilbert. I love you, Gilbert. Even though I'm not giving the movie personal, four apples, I give it maybe
it's
three.
It's very close to the Gilbert I know.
Well, the thing, the problem with Bill is he's no surprises for him.
I think
fans will go and see this and get a lot from it, and Bill will just go, "Oh, that's just my Tuesday."
Yeah, it's a, you know.
Is Gilbert happy with the film?
Yeah, he's happy. He's happy. It's getting good reviews.
Well, here's a treat because of Bill Bregoli's BFF with Gilbert Gottfried. We have an exclusive interview with Bill Bregoli. Will you set it up, Bill?
Okay. Yeah. Well,
not just Gilbert
was there, as well as Dara and director Neil Berkeley. And I started by asking Neil why he chose Gilbert.
Well, I grew up in the 80s, and so, you know, Gilbert was always there. He was always in movies and TV shows and doing stand-up. And I was a big fan of that 80s, like, brick wall boom. So I always knew who he was. And then my first movie has a Pee-wee's Playhouse storyline. So I got real curious about what it's like to be a character, have a persona. And so I was looking around, and, you know, there's Emo Phillips and Bob Goldthwait and obviously Paul Rubens. And I realized that Gilbert's, you know, has always been what we see on stage, and I knew nothing about him. So being a documentary filmmaker, I started to get very curious. And the wild story is I started telling people I was going to do it. Just anyone that would listen, I would say, I'm going to make a Gilbert Gottfried movie. So much that even though I never called his agent or his manager and actually tried to do it, one day I was walking down 6th Avenue with this woman named Astrid Dorff, and we were working together at the time. And she said, "What's your next movie going to be about?" And like always, I said, "It's going to be about Gilbert Gottfried. Just said it." And she looked at me like she was concerned. And I was like, "Oh, God, this she hates Gilbert Gottfried." She goes, "No, it's weird you said that to me because his wife is my best friend, and they live right over there." So I met Dara that night, and we had lunch the next day. And about 9 months later, Dara said, "Look, just come out and start shooting, and who knows?" And so I moved to New York and just started going to their house every day.
Wow. And Dara, you must have been like, I don't know, what was it like for you to have a crew come in and then talk
there
about
wasn't a crew.
Relationship? Or,
we, there was know. Never a crew. It was just Neil and his camera, so it didn't feel intrusive at all. And he's a great guy, and he became part of the family, and it just was like a fun little home movie. It didn't feel strange or anything. And then a lot of times
he's part of the family, that like that uncle you don't want visiting you.
And he would go on the road with Gilbert, so I didn't see him, you know, all that much because he would be on the road a lot with Gilbert. I think they went to 15 cities.
Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah, 15. Yeah. Mexico, Toronto.
Right. And I just knew as long as Neil was with Gilbert that Gilbert would be fed, so I was happy.
Yeah, that was my job.
And Neil came up to me at one point and he said, "I've always dreamt about doing a Gilbert Gottfried documentary." And I said to him, "Well, you should set your dreams a lot higher than that." And it's funny, I never agreed to do it. I never wanted a documentary because I always felt like, aren't you supposed to be dead for 30 years before a documentary comes out? Or that you're helping starving children somewhere, opening schools in some third world country. I'm just too much of a wimp to say, get away from me. So he did. He would show up at my house, see me with my kids, and follow me to comedy clubs. Yeah, very, very peculiar.
But you're happy how it turned out.
Yeah. I mean, what amazes me is the amount of great reviews it's gotten. I mean, it always surprises me because I'm always waiting for them to say, Gilbert Gottfried sucks and I don't like watching him. But instead, the reviews have been really surprising.
Well, my favorite part was the Nazis telling you jokes was probably the highlight.
It was in Chicago, and it was a war reenactment was going on in one floor of the hotel.
But every war. Every
yeah,
war
yes.
that's ever been fought was represented.
And yeah, there was the Civil War, Korea, Vietnam, World War I. And, of course, my favorite, World War II. And that part was really like a gift from God when you're making a movie. And it's odd to say that the Third Reich was a gift from God. But it was so surreal because Nazi officers would be there wearing swastikas and the Iron Cross, and they were running over to me excited, yelling that Problem Child was their favorite movie, and they all wanted selfies with me, and they were all like giggling and nervous around me, and you have that feeling of, gee, I've been wrong about the Nazis all this time.
Yeah, so I was talking to them, and they were, you know, nice enough guys. And I was like, hey, you should come to the show tonight, because the club was in the hotel, but no one related to that at all. And I thought they would just go home and change clothes and come out to the club. And I was out there, and I came backstage, and I was like, Gilbert, the Nazis are here. And they were in there with their uniforms drinking daiquiris and toasting. It was bizarre.
It was like Berlin at a nightclub. Yeah. The Nazi officers, you know, like laughing and clinking their glasses.
You know, another great part with Darren, it is the collection of hotel soaps underneath the bed.
Well, yeah, because Gilbert, every hotel you check into, the first thing you do is ask for extra soaps and shampoos
yes.
and shaving creams and the toothbrush kit and the sewing kit and the mouthwash and everything else you could get for free. So
then when I go up to my room, the first thing I do is go into the bathroom and see what they have there is lotions and shampoos.
Yeah, so I collect it all for him because yes. he brings it all home in little bags, and I try to keep it organized and store it for him.
There's actually a really sweet moment in the movie where Dara's talking about how they met. And at the end, she's saying how she does all this just to make sure he's comfortable. And she's vacuum sealing a shirt into a bag. But if you watch the beginning of the movie, Gilbert's wearing that shirt on Arsenio Hall like 25 years ago, the same
yes.
shirt, and she's vacuum sealing it that day. Unintentional. We noticed it as we were making the movie. We're like, wait a minute, that's the shirt from Arsenio Hall.
He won't throw anything away.
And when I was wearing it on Arsenio Hall, it was already out of date.
I remember when you were dating, when we first met, you and I were going to a screening. We ran into Dara on Broadway. And you were like embarrassed, like, the big secret was out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always been incredibly uncomfortable just about different worlds meeting, but also so secretive about my life. It's like if a reporter asked me, so what's your favorite candy to eat when you want a candy? And it's like there's a part of me that goes, oh, I don't want to reveal stuff about myself.
Well, you had your friend JJ called the house when we had first moved in. We moved in after 10 years of being together. And JJ from California called the house, and I answered the phone. He's like, "Who's this?" I said, "It's Dara, Gilbert's girlfriend." He had no idea that you even had a girlfriend, and we had been dating 10 years.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I didn't know it either. Like, the day I started shooting was the first day I met the kids, and that was the first day I met his sister, Arlene. It's all like when you meet all these people, you kind of meet them as I got to meet them. Like, I didn't know anything about this personal life at all the day I showed up and hit record. I mean, it's all sort of a discovery, and you kind of see it as I learned about it.
And then they also get to see Max and Lily.
Yeah.
I mean, Max stole, I don't know, Neil, you saw the celebrity wife swap that they did with Alan Thicke when Max is pulling down Barbie's clothes.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
A moment that will live in Disney TV history.
I thought like father, like son. Yeah.
Yeah, if you watch the, I have a theory about the kids, and I've talked to Dare about this. When you watch the movie, and it does come across like Max is the performance Gilbert, and Lily's very much the Gilbert that you see just in a room at lunch or backstage. Like they really meet. I think that's what I think anyway. She's,
she's
very stoic and calm, and he's very outgoing and excited. And
Max is, he's like, he likes to joke around. He's always kidding, and he's out there in front of people, and he's the center of attention. And Lily tends to be me when I'm around a group of people and I don't want to be there and all that stuff.
Well, my favorite Max moment at the apartment was I brought over some Playboys, and they're in an envelope like they are now, and we put them on the table under the Groucho picture. And about 10 minutes later, Dara and I are talking, and Max shows up and goes, "Look, boobies." It's like a little zombie transfix. Well, what do you hope people get from watching this?
Syphilis.
No, I think one of the most satisfying things is that every comic that's seen it has said, "This is good. Thank you for making it. He's one of our guys. He's one of our own. Thank you for honoring him and making this movie about him." And also a lot of the stuff about, you know, we are people. We have families and we have parents and we have regrets and doubts and fears. And they're very thankful that we showed an honest story about a comic that's been doing it for over 45 years.
And so many reviews, it's weird. So many reviews have said, and it sounds like a phony blurb that you put on your own poster, but they've said you'll laugh and you'll cry.
As you know, I do this. Part of this is going to be in a podcast I do with Neil Rosen, and Gilbert knows Neil.
Hi, Neil.
You can imagine his. If you can imagine his quote.
Yeah. Neil Rosen says, "The documentary Gilbert gets 5,000 apples. Greatest film ever made. The reason film was invented. Neil Rosen."
All right, I guess I got to give it 10,000 apples then. I mean, I guess so, three
but
apples
a couple will be wormy.
So, Bill, can I start the hashtag Gilbert BFF?
Wow, yeah. Let's see if we can get that trending by next week. Speaking of next week, we got...
This is not long enough. Just isn't long enough.
Next week, we'll be talking about Murder on the Orient Express, which they haven't shown to any critics. I wish I could ask their surprise. They're showing it Monday. Yeah. I don't know why they remade that. Everyone in the world knows.
Daddy's Home 2. There's a movie that you've been waiting for, haven't you?
Well, you know what? It looks terrible now, but the original trailer I saw where it was just John Lithgow and Mel Gibson coming down at the airport and meeting the kids looked hilarious. And then now I've seen the extended trailer, which is just a bunch of stupid crotch gags, and I'm not looking forward to that. Mayhem is also coming out. Thelma, huh?
Crotch gags.
You're
here's
a crotch
a movie
gag man.
That's coming out next week that I really want to talk about that's going to also
it's get the only good one.
Academy Award nominations, and it's called Three Billboards.
Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Outside Ebbing, Missouri, and it's with Frances McDormand and with Woody Harrelson. We had two, it's funny, we had Lady Bird today, the movie, which had nothing to do with Lady Bird Johnson, and we had LBJ, which did deal with Lady Bird Johnson.
And so, Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri, and there were never three billboards outside of Ebbing,
Missouri. Not interesting. thing. Anyway,
we got two Bills and Neil and a mic.
There you go. Well, anyway, I think we've taken up enough of your time today, and we thank you for sitting around talking movies with us. For Bill Brigoli, Mike Sargent, Bill McCuddy.
We watch the bad everything, so you don't have to.
I was going
to
ask you for your line, your signature, you know, phrase.
I was trying to make it shorter, but as usual, you made it longer anyway.
We'll sit around talking movies with you again next week.